Hey, welcome, welcome tonight. We finally got some winter. Yay! Enough of this. How are the roads out there? Anybody from the hill towns?
They're all right.
They're all right? Kind of sort of? What?
The roads are fine. The sidewalks here are not.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The sidewalks here are very tricky, so be very careful when you leave. But right below the steps, there's a big pile of something. So
steps
are bad too.
Yeah.
So we can't leave the building till it melts. Okay. So I want to thank my board, Dan and Peter and Fair and Chris and Carol and anybody else here tonight. And I think that there are a few others who aren't here. So if you want to get on our email list, if you're not, please sign up and write very clearly so we can understand your name and your email address, which can sometimes be difficult. How many people found us through a newspaper? Okay, good, good. How many people are from Vermont? Anybody from, probably not today, huh? Okay. So I'm going to ask Chris to say a few words about books and donations.
Some of you may know we now have books on offer, which you'll find over on the table on the side. The board was able to buy up a treasure trove of books about Jungian psychology, and they're available to you on a donation basis. So please just follow the extremely reasonable guidelines here for making a donation if you find a book that you like. We hope to be bringing some books every time, so if you don't have a chance tonight, you'll have another chance another time. And we are an organization that depends on your donations. Because we don't charge, we do ask that you put some money in the basket. And I always appreciate seeing people put money in the basket, but I actually identify with the people that don't. It's really easy to cruise by the basket. I know, because that's what I did for about 3 years. I thought, oh, other people, you know, are putting money in the basket. I don't need to do that. And then I joined the board, and I reevaluated my position. I realized that I get so much of value here, and I discovered that giving back was very satisfying. So if you find something of value here, please consider completing your circle and giving back. You'll appreciate it on the inside, as well as we will appreciate it so we can continue our programming. Thank you.
Boy, that was eloquent. Thank you, Chris.
Oh, you can put money on the way out as well as on the way in.
Great. Thank you, Chris. Okay, also, we have a flyer for our next time. So if you are in a place where you could put up a flyer, because we can't get around everywhere, please take one and put it up for us. That's one of the ways we do our advertising. So, as a lot of people know, we don't take a break tonight, and the bathroom that says men is for everybody, of course, wordsmith. So, please feel free to go to the bathroom and come back, but we will not take a break. And after, we have a salon. We had 15 people the last time at the Mosaic Cafe on Masonic Street. And so if you can stay out and have a cup of tea and have some interesting talk after, it'd be wonderful. And Carol's going to be there tonight, Carol Beauvais, and other people, I hope, too. Do you want to say something, Bill? No. So the next one is on Michelangelo. It's by a Jungian analyst from Boston, Russell Holmes. He's a wonderful, he was a priest many, many, many years ago, became a Jungian analyst. And he's going to be talking about the three pietas, a lecture by Russell Holmes. And that's Friday, March 4th. It's always the first Friday of the month. Ah, thank you. It's not here. No, it is here.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, the one in April.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep, yep. Okay. So tonight we have the embodied and conscious, which is probably why everybody came. Because we all need to get embodied in our culture. We're so disembodied. And we have Anita Green, who's a local analyst, one of our long-standing local analysts. And what I can say about Anita Green very quickly is that she has lived a deep, rich, and embodied life. And she'll tell you all about it. So let's welcome her.
Wonderful to see so many of you here, but if you're an old New Englander like I am, this is nothing. Anyway, now, I would rather stand and project my voice. Can you hear me in the back row? If I let my voice go down, please raise your hand. But I would rather not be confined to the mic if I don't have to be, okay? But I can go to that, because I hope my voice lasts, and I've got some lozenges and some water here. Anyway, I had this for the archetypal affects, too. I love this one, because I want to remind us how much of a critter we all are. Someone, when I used this last time, asked me, what happens when that kid finds out he's not a pug? I don't know. Anyway, I'm going to be talking about the embodied unconscious. And I'm wondering, I'm going to start with this. Are we today losing our senses as we become increasingly invaded by a virtual world? Richard Kearney, I don't know if you know who he is, but he wrote something for the New York Times Sunday section some time ago. He's a professor at Boston College, and he does a class on Eros most every year, Eros from Plato to the modern time. And he gets the class engaged in the discussion, and often the discussion, obviously, turns to sex and to their sexual kinds of rites and passage and so forth. So in the general conversation, many of them admitted that they regularly went online using a dating service before they had any real contact with a potential partner. They also express what, in euphemism, so directly, I imagine, what they might be willing to do or not do in a sexual encounter. This is called a hookup. And it's very different when Thayer and I were courting back in the 50s. I mean, it's a whole different world. And I know you had to court for a long time to persuade me to marry you, but thank God you did. Anyway. This is the first time I put this together, so bear with me. Now, actually, a hookup doesn't have any responsibility for anybody. And some enjoyed the anonymity. They didn't have to get to know. There was no shared meal, no courting rituals. All you did was meet for a night in bed. And they were willing to settle for the short, pleasurable experience of a night with sex. No responsibility for either one. Now, Kearney, the professor at Boston, wondered if we were living in a world with which he called of excarnation rather than incarnation. Excarnation divests itself of flesh, of deep interpersonal encounter, whereas incarnation invests itself in flesh. And it enhances it makes us more vulnerable, doesn't it? I mean, you can hide behind words on the computer. You can fancy up your qualities and all of that sort of thing. And when you meet someone face-to-face, that's not so possible. So vulnerability is one thing that happens. And it increases our empathic sense, our positive empathic sense, and our capacity to enter into where the other person lives. So he's wondering if we're in an era of excarnation. Now, according to this professor, Kearney, and I imagine he grew up in another time than the hookup, because to love and be loved truly is to be able to say, flesh to flesh, face to face, eye to eye, I have been deeply touched by you, and I speak from my heart. And that's how the piece ended in the Times. I thought it was very good. You know, virtual reality has been around a lot longer than the computer, but the computer makes it easy for us all to engage in it. Jung himself, particularly when he got involved in something called the Vision Seminars, and he took the dreams and the fantasies of a woman he had worked with for a short time, Christiana Morgan, and he just took off archetypally. There was no relationship to her as a patient, as an ordinary human being, and he used her fantasies and dreams for his opportunity to show, well, he knew a great deal about the archetypal world, but toward the end of the lectures, I think he wondered if he wasn't just taking off and not being very grounded. And so he writes something in the second volume of the Vision Seminars. And I think he's writing to himself as well as to other Jungians. He says, whatever you experience outside of the body, in a dream, for instance, is not experienced unless you take it into the body. Because the body means the here and now. If you do not take it into some kind of embodied experience, and I love this, you weren't there when it happened. So he was off in some kind of a virtual world. And now it's much easier for all of us to go into that world. I work with several physicians and nurses and people in the helping professions. And to a man and to a woman, they all lament what's happening in medicine and in the helping professions. For example, when one goes to the emergency room, not only do you wait a long time, but the narrative that you want to give to someone who asks you questions is usually very perfunctory. You're sent off to have tests. And if you've been to that hospital many times before, they look these up already that are on the computer. You know, the blood test, the echocardiogram. And they don't take much time to really listen to the patient. Now, this isn't all hospitals, granted. And to a man and woman, they really feel that the narrative that they get when they take time with a patient and really sit and listen, and it's often the way they say it more than the content of what they say, that gives them all kinds of clues as to what is really the right diagnosis for this person. And they feel, collectively, that the patient's narratives is being lost to technology and efficiency. And I think that's true, because the greatest gift we can give to anyone, to a partner, to just someone as a doctor and a patient or a therapist, is to be fully, physically, embodiedly present to them and to really listen. Okay. So, just take a look at your right hand for a minute. Are you sure it's your right hand? I mean, how do you know you have a body? I mean, do you know the extent of it? Do you know where it begins, where it ends? Just for a moment, divide your body in half and touch the right side of your head and your ear and your shoulder and your waist and your thigh and your knee. Are you all there? I mean, how do you know the knee isn't the elbow? Now, you can tell these body parts one from another, particularly the right side. But first of all, you know, just take your right eyebrow with your right and the right part of your lip. I mean, how do you know that's an eyebrow and that's... You sure this isn't your eyebrow? Or this isn't your lip? I'm serious. Because how do we know that we belong to ourselves? That our bodies are ours? Because the brain... Well, the right side, you know, the brain crosses over. I have a two-dimensional part of my brain that specializes in touch, and it's mapped there. So every time I touch the surface of my body, on the right side, it gets mapped over here. And every time I touch my body or someone touches it, it's mapped over here. Now, the brain has, I mean, each toe, each finger, each hand, every part of ourselves is mapped in the brain. Now, I love road maps. I'd rather have one in my lap than those things in the car that's supposed to tell you where to go. Because I can see the length of it, I can see where the road's curvy, a back road, I can see whether it's, you know, the 90 or something of that sort. And a map, every point I know on that map has a point and a position and a place in reality, in the real world. I mean, where I begin, which is often my home, that's a place that I know well, and I'm moving toward a destination, and I know those places are represented by reality. The same is true for the maps in the brain. They represent each part of us. And also the spatial distance between them is represented very well, too. I mean, the toes are near the body in the maps, near the knee and the thigh, you know, they're together. And they correspond to real positions in the body. Let me change that delightful one. Let's see, it's the right one to go ahead. No, I've already done that one. Now, I just want us to become aware. All I'm talking about in the first 2.5 to 3 years of life is incarnation. Learning to be fully settled into and feel comfortable with the flesh that we are born into. And if I overwhelm you by all the details, I want you to be overwhelmed. Because I just found out about all of these things and I'm putting together. It's incredible. Did you know that the baby has many, many, many more neurons than an adult? And you'll see why when you figure out all that they have to learn in 2.5 years. I mean, it's pretty incredible. Now, these are the flesh-bound senses. I'm not even putting up sight, smell, hearing, taste, because they're sort of taken for granted. But they're all alive, of course, in the womb and at birth. These are the flesh-bound senses, and we all had them. Now, touch is the mother of all senses, and they respond to pressure. Gentle pressure, deep pressure, sustained pressure, hair follicle bending and vibration, and many other things. Touch is by far the most prominent of the somatic senses. These receptor cells, the thermo, hot and cold, temperature, one for warm and one for cold. And when something is dangerously cold or freezing, you move on to the next nociception, the pain receivers in our body. The raw material for pain reception comes from these, is it noci? I think noci in Latin, probably noci, is Latin for injury or trauma. There are several types: piercing pain, heat pain, chemical pain, joint pain, deep tissue pain, tickle and itch, and many more. Proprioception. I'm just going through these just so you get a sense of the flesh-bound senses. Our very own sensory cells. And this is our inherent sense of the body's position. And they're more embedded in the muscles and tendons, limb position. And one shows how far, when we move them, and limb speed and direction. And then there's a vestibular sense, balance. Now that happens to be, unlike the other somatic senses, not in places all over the body, but in two places in your ears, your inner ears. And they're special balance organs. Now you know when you wake up and you have an infection in your ear, you can't even get out of bed. And I think you've all had experience when that is off and we don't have any sense of balance whatsoever. Now this is an indispensable ingredient in how we operate in the world. And it's been around for billions of years, and we share it with every critter that has a spine. And they was crafted so well that it's hardly been changed over the billions of years. So that's the most ancient flesh-bound sense. Now we have all those, so you can see, begin to see why a baby needs more neurons than we have. Then we have a primary motor map. And that exists in a two-dimensional swatch, both on the right and the left sides. This map outputs signals to your muscles. This movement, it's vital to your ability to do large movements, like playing tennis, soccer, and for fine-tuned movements, like shuffling cards, knitting, and then making small ship and airplane models. So this is a very, very important, another mapping, for example. Every movement we do is mapped in one side of the brain, maybe both sides at the same time. So you can imagine all of this happening when we're still in the womb and when we're born. Then, I didn't know this, there's a visceral map. All your body's innards are mapped in your various parts of a brain. And it's more developed in humans, and it gives you a level of access to the ebb and flow of your internal sensations that most animals don't have. Well, I'm not sure about our beloved dog and cat. I think they probably do too. Anyway, all of these maps are all of our lobes, parietal, occipital, and so forth, are mapped heavily in all these ways. And then there's a map, the last one there, that automatically tracks and emulates the actions and intentions of other people around you. Now, I've talked about this before. So, all of these maps, we are a network of flexible body maps. And they expand and contract at different age-appropriate times. We can map something over them if our skill at tennis gets better. The more that we can hit a good serve, the more it's mapped more correctly in our brain. And so I think this is what people are talking about when they talk about the plasticity of the brain. Because of the ability to change and move and expand and contract all of these maps. Okay. Let me just remind you, it wasn't until the mid-1950s that so-called mirror neurons, the one that can apprehend others' motion and intentions, were discovered. And it happened in a lab in Parma, Italy. Now, before we had all this imaging stuff to trace what's going on in the brain, the only way that people knew what part of the brain did whatever was when people had a terrible accident and they had to take out part of the brain to keep the person alive. And then they would see what deficits the person had and say, okay, that's the part of the brain that does this and that. Or they were in labs because they knew in general where the motor maps were. And in this particular, this was in Parma, Italy, in a lab with the researcher named Giacomo Pizzolatti. What a wonderful Italian name. He had a monkey all strapped up in a chair. You realize they couldn't do this on humans because they had to cut through the skull and wire the monkey's head up to all the machines so that when the monkey reached out and grabbed a banana, the bells and whistles went off, and then they could tell in the brain what spot that particular neuron was. When he reached up, that was another spot. When he reached out this way, there was another spot. So they could begin to map, and it was similar to a human's brain, obviously, or they wouldn't have been doing this. Now, they worked all morning, and then they went out and had lunch. And they came back, and one of the research assistants still had his gelato, and he was licking it. And all of a sudden, they heard the bells and whistles go off in the machines. And they looked at the monkey, and he was just sitting there, his arms resting. Although he was intently gazing at the research assistant that was licking the cone. They couldn't believe what they saw. And it was several years before Giacomo wanted to write about this because he thought all his colleagues would think he was crazy, and a lot of them did. And there's still a lot of research going on around mirror neurons, but I do believe that they exist. Now, so they call these cells mirror neurons because he was sitting there not doing anything, and yet subliminally he was, so that the motor cortex was at work. Now, my voice went down, my husband said, can you still hear me back there? Okay. So, this is a physiological basis for attunement. And for humans, it's more evolved. Not only can we tell, I mean, for example, if I take the glass, which I will right now, and lift it up to my lips, you won't be doing anything, but your motor cortex will be activated because you know this movement. And it's mapped in your brain. However, in humans, not only these movements, but we can sort of get to the intentions of another. A baby, for example, immediately knows the mood of its mother. By the way the mother picks up the baby, by the way she speaks to it, by the way she handles it, the baby knows immediately what the mood of the mother is. And the mother knows the mood of the baby. They are like in each other's skin. Now let me do you know who Daniel Goleman is? He wrote a very popular book called Molecules of Emotion. And he says mirror neurons are related to the fact that we are social creatures. It allows us to grasp the minds of others, not through reasoning, not through feeling, but through direct simulation. Now that's something. Now Daniel Stern puts it a little more directly, and he's done a lot of infant research and wrote a book called The Present Moment, among many other books. He says, our neuronal systems are constructed to be captured by the nervous systems of others, so that we can experience others as if from within their skin as well as from within our own. That we can experience others as if from within their skin as well as from within our own. Isn't that a little scary? I think it is. But we can do that. Now, we can get into each other's skin. Now, if we don't have some empathic sense, we end up being sociopaths. And they say they don't have mirror neurons, but I think they do, because empathy is a very neutral word. It's used very positively in this day and age, but it also means negative kinds of thoughts. And a good sociopath will know immediately where your weakness is and move in, but their empathy is very negative. And they somehow have learned that only by controlling and by manipulating can they be safe or be human or be superior or whatever. So a sociopath does have mirror neurons, but they're used mostly negatively, getting into the skin of others. I use Margaret here because I didn't know where to put her, but she's a wonderful colleague, a British colleague of mine. She's very much a thinking type, and she realized from all of the neurobiological and infant research that she had to do something more with the right brain than the left. She was very good at that, the left. So she went and studied neurobiology from some of the most prominent teachers in England. And she says, "I work with mine primarily, yet increasingly I realize how much attention I do pay now that I've been alerted to it in the work. How is this patient affecting me? By what he or she says, by what he or she makes me feel emotionally, and by what bodily sensations he or she is able to evoke in me." Would that all therapists could ask those questions. Because I think all the research is showing that we need to use our right brain much more in terms of the therapeutic process than our left. I think what I had been doing last year and the year before on archetypal affects, which are universal affects, that you can pick those up immediately when someone is feeling shame or anger or grief or disgust. They are bodily based. I think all emotions are bodily based. For example, we don't have fear and then tremble. No, first we tremble. First we try to hide, and then we put a name like shame to it. The trembling, we finally found cognitively a name in our language to put to it, fear. Actually, Darwin said that he learned more from his infant sons and daughters and toddlers than he almost did from anywhere else. He saw every emotion in their bodies already. But they didn't know what they were. But what baby or toddler do we ever know that doesn't react with the whole being, the whole body? We know, for example, if we're in a small group, social scientists know this because they're always videotaping people in groups, meeting at bars or whatever, and they know from the way they approach the person, the way they move back, whether they're engaged with the person or whether they're not. When a person enters our little group, for example, and has just had a wonderful time, a wonderful experience, filled with joy, you know, the energy just goes up like this. We pick it up immediately. When someone comes, for example, with a deep depression, or maybe they've just lost a loved one, and they're in deep grief, the energy goes like this. So we all have had experience of that happening to us. So, let me see. As I say, just give me a moment. I'm trying to... So, the primal archetypal affects particularly shame, disgust, anger, fear, grief, and combinations of them are experienced immediately by us, like we're in the skin of the other person, or they can be in our skin. When someone is in pain, in deep grief, the pain sensors in our brain start activating. Now, since our brains are networks of maps, I'm sorry, but the way you're sitting so close together, your body maps are all mixed up. I don't know whether that feels comfortable or not. But we usually, you know, our sense of self doesn't stop with the flesh, with the skin. You know, as far as we can reach, that's called peripersonal space. Okay, let me go back to... she wouldn't do that. Okay. This doesn't happen on the internet. This is an example of every... We're both swimming in that sensory world. He's being held, touches the main thing. I think they can still hear me in the back, but let me know if you can't. Okay. Okay? All right. Touch is very important. I'm holding... This is my grandson, about a month and a half old. And I had just gone to see him. I was holding him securely. Sight... you know, we could smell each other's bodies. I was singing lullabies to him, and he was responding with babies. And we were looking deeply into each other's eyes. Now, some people have told me that they can't stand being with babies very long because they look so directly into one's soul. And that's true. They really do. And our eyes were very connected. My daughter Allison, whose baby this is, was sorry she didn't get me and my head in at the same time. But that just shows you how important that is. I wonder, women who are nursing their babies and use the time to answer their cell phones and do all of that, with the baby right here and not looking and gazing as I am here. I mean, you're missing out on something very, very important. That's important to the baby as well as to the mother. We know, for example, from René Spitz, who went around to orphanages after World War II, that babies can be kept clean and fed on time and clean sheets and all the rest of it, and after 2 years... if they do not get to move around, if a mother or some kind of caregiver isn't playing with them or rocking them or talking to them or letting them move in their encaged, they stay in their encaged cribs a lot of the time, they die after 2 years. Many of them do. There are some that hang on. May some of you remember when the Romanians were allowing Americans to come over and adopt people from their orphanages. Some of the older people will certainly remember that. And I don't know how well they were cared for because birth control was not allowed. I mean, something like that. He wanted a lot of people. He wanted babies. And so they were put in, a lot of families just put them in orphanages. I don't know that they were kept all that well. But it's called failure to thrive. I know there's a more clinical name for it. I can't think what it is. But it's failure to thrive. And these 3 and 4 years olds had lost the time-appropriate stages of growth when it's very important for them to be with another person. And actually what they needed to do was to attach them to their mothers at 4 or 5 so they could be babies again and try to go through the stages which they missed. Very important. If they could. Now, some time ago, and I can't remember the date, but someone in a large city hospital decided that they would do an experiment on their preemies. And they had enough, so they divided them into two groups. And the first group, they teach the mothers who came to see their babies and nurses how to touch for 15 minutes, 3 times a day. It was a firm touch. And it really, they were told to touch the baby and be very present and feel the baby's skin and all the baby's limbs. And 3 times a day for 15 minutes. And the other group was told nothing. They had to stop the experiment because the babies who were touched developed almost double the ones that were not. And now most hospitals with their preemies have touch going on because it's such an important thing. If we touch ourselves and our brain maps that, it's so important for the mother's touch or the primary caregiver or everyone in the family to touch, because that stimulates, again, those map centers. And it's so important. This was a very special moment, obviously. And I hope all of you will have it at some point, whether you work with children or have grandchildren. It made me sad because I didn't do that so often with my own children. I was too frantic a mother. But it's something to being a grandmother. You have that special time. You can have that. And maybe some of you have that experience too. Now, Winnicott, he was a pediatrician. He was the only psychoanalyst I know who actually handled babies. And he said, there's no baby without a mother. And Eric Neumann, who's a Jungian, who wrote a book called The Child, also understood the importance of touch. And let me see if that's on. Let me see. Can't even remember. Oh, we'll leave that for now. Let me go back. I think you can get the sense of what Neumann and Winnicott are saying with just letting yourself get into that experience. Winnicott says, and so does Neumann, that the mother carries the body self and the psyche self in her own person. Because there's only a symbiotic relationship first. And only the mother sees the baby and she is separate. The baby still experiences the mother as very connected. And the mother carries that, carries the body self, the psychic self of the baby, and through play and handling, and here touch is so important, is constantly introducing and reintroducing the baby's body and psyche to each other. The other is so important. We are constructed to need other embodied neural networks in order to become human. That's just the way it is. Freud was right. The first self is a body self. And I always tell people, and I taught the class to Boston Institute not too long ago, in which I told them that it was important to learn how to experience the nonverbal, and the emotional in a therapy session. And a couple of men raised, or one woman and one man, raised their hands and they said, well, we're thinking types. We can't do that. And I said, I don't care. We all, no matter whether you're a thinking type or a feeling type or sensei type or an intuitive type, if you follow Jung's typology, we all started out life as emotionally reactive embodied beings, rubbing up against other emotionally reactive embodied beings. And we need them. We need other embodied neural networks in order for our own to grow. You know that Pfeiffer cartoon that I often show? It shows a man praising his head and all the wonderful things it can do, imaginatively. And he doesn't like his body very much. He says he prefers it in an overcoat. And it's too much of a body. He says, but the only reason I keep my body, he says, is because it taxis my head around. Well, what can I say? Your body does not exist to carry your brain around. In human life, there's no such thing as a disembodied consciousness. Your early sensory world, your motor ability to move, to react, and your many flexible body maps in all parts of the brain, they are what gives you a solid, stable feeling sense of meanness. So, yeah, your right hand and your arm and left do belong to you. Your body is you. And that's where you get the first sense of I, or of meanness. And they create a way for you to understand and move about as a separate person in the outside world. Now, this is a wonderful little book. I don't know if any of you know that or not. It's The Body Has a Mind of Its Own. And it's written by two science writers. I think they work both for the New York Times. Sandra Blakeslee and her son, Matthew. And this comes from their book. And if this is a helpful image, use it. If it's not, you don't have to. Anyway. How we do it. Okay. A mandala is... This is a mandala. I don't know who drew that one. But it is a represent... You start with a center, and then you move to the periphery. But you can look at it as all of the concentric stuff around it is part of your body map, a part of your body maps. And the center... you can read it right there. A mandala is both an appealing metaphor and a convenient shorthand for referring to your brain's far-flung, yet tightly integrated network of body maps. Following this analogy, the peripheral figures of the body, mandala, are your many cortical body maps, the large and the small, all intricately interconnected. The central figure is their composite product, the central figure, a seamless sense of a whole, indivisible, embodied self. So if that's helpful as an image, go ahead and use it. Okay. Not too long ago, and this was in the Boston Sunday Globe, there was an article about baby mind and adult mind. Did anyone see it? Did you? I think I said at the beginning that a baby has many, many, many more neurons than the adult. We start pruning as soon as we're born. And that brings focus, and it means sometimes not hearing other things around if we're wanting to focus. But focus sometimes gets to be quite constrictive, and it doesn't help us to be creative at sometimes. So that, you know, a baby has so much to learn in 2 to 3 years, not just going from random movements to sitting up, to crawling, to standing, to walking, to running, but all the language that they learn and everything else. And anyone who's gone for a walk with a toddler, as I have many times, will realize that they see so much more than you do when you're out for a walk. For example, I went with Rowan when he was a toddler. He was a baby there, obviously. And he saw a caterpillar crawling on a curb. And then he saw a bird eating a nut in a tree. And then he saw a cat sneaking around the house, I think, to get out of his reach. I hadn't noticed them until he pointed them out to me. And babies have an unfiltered consciousness. Everything comes in as is, and it's only now. That's the only thing they know, is now. Now, until 1970, if you can imagine it, it makes my skin crawl. But surgeons used to operate on babies because they supposedly had less consciousness than adults without anesthesia. Can you imagine? They're more sensitive than adults. It actually takes more ether or anesthetic so that they won't feel pain. It's absolutely incredible. Okay. So having a fully developed adult brain can sometimes be an impediment. You know, we prune, we get rid of the pathways that we don't use, and we make the maps. We can get caught in ruts, of course, with something happening over and over again, so it becomes a habit or a rut we can't get out of. Our ability to focus our attention sometimes stifles creativity. Now, I don't know how many of you like jazz, but if you have watched jazz musicians improvise, and they've done experiments with special pianos and brain scans, and they show that the lobe here, the frontal lobe, turns off when they are really into improvising. It's almost like they go into baby mind again, rather than adult mind. And that releases them and allows them to come up with melodies they wouldn't even think of ahead of time. I mean, when they're really with it, it is absolutely amazing to watch. So, don't worry if you get distracted. You maybe want to go back into baby mind. Let me see. Where do I want to go next? Okay. Let me just quickly say something here. Your embodied sense obviously doesn't stop with the skin. If I could, I would have you all stand and reach out as far and put your legs out. This is your, what they call, peripersonal space. You're embodied in this. So your body maps are all mixed up, as I said before, because you're sitting so close together. Let's see here. When I have a massage with a really skilled practitioner, the way she gets into my skin and the way her hands conform to my body and the way I'm receiving it, we're in sync. You know? Our body maps are in sync. when you make love, for example, if you're with someone that you really care about, your body maps are in sync and mingle together in your desire for each other. I think our cat Snuggles, my husband there was a dog person until Snuggles came along. He's the only one that sits in front of the TV with his legs up on a footstool. And because he watches baseball, he watches the Red Sox, and that's a long period for 9 innings. And the cat would climb up and put her tail up into his upper groin and then stretch out along his legs to the knees and beyond and put her paws like this. And she stayed there for hours.
She was a Red Sox fan.
Of course. But I swear their body maps were in full synchrony. Okay. My youngest daughter,
Anita?
Yeah.
Let me interrupt just a minute.
You go ahead. Anyone can interrupt at any time. Yeah.
Someone asked me once, you know, how much analysis that I've done, how many analysts that I had. I said I'd had, oh my God, I can't remember, 4 or 5. And then she said, have you been in analysis since your training? I said, oh yeah, a couple of times. As a matter of fact, I'm really in therapy right now. And she said, oh, can I ask who your analyst is? And I said, her name is Snuggles. Because Snuggles taught me a great deal.
Yes, she did. That's for sure. My daughter is a horsewoman. And really a horse whisperer. I mean, she's always loved horses. She trains them, she competes, she events, and that sort of thing. When I watch her ride, I see how her rhythm and the horse's rhythm are synchronous. She's a very good rider. And I look and I know, I didn't know it then, but now I can say their body maps are commingled, obviously. For example, if we have a tool or a tennis racket, our arm goes out all the way to the end of the tennis racket. It becomes part of us. Let's say a batter like Ted Williams or Babe Ruth, that bat is a part of their peripersonal space, and the way they swing it becomes part of them. When we get in a car, for example, our peri-personal space goes from the front bumper to the back, from the roof to the wheels and the side doors. And when we get hit or someone comes into our car and smashes it, we feel personally violated. That's for sure. So there's an embodiedness that goes out, and it's not... I mean, even though we're as introverted as can be, I think the extroverted body, personal space of an introvert, probably isn't as large as an extrovert's, but I've never researched that.
Anita?
Yeah.
When you said that, I was just thinking of Star Wars.
Okay.
The scene where Obi-Wan is teaching Luke.
Obi-Wan is teaching Luke
how to feel the Force.
How to feel the Force.
And he has the lightsaber.
Okay.
And Obi-Wan, and he's concentrating, and Obi-Wan puts something over his head. He says, okay, now feel it.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Do you all know that scene from Star Wars? Okay. Well, you don't have to. When you have a cowboy hat on top of your head, you will automatically duck when you go under a low kind of a ceiling because it's become part of you. It makes complete sense that kids can get caught in video games completely. And so can we get caught in a pornographic site. I mean, it doesn't, it's not only the images that draw us in, but because we have some body maps of our own body pleasuring, our bodies are drawn in, and the virtual becomes reality very often. It's really strange that way. But it's understandable when you think of all the body maps we have and all the experience we've had, why it becomes very addictive. And we get pulled in not just with the mind from the images, but with our whole bodies. The first, as you can see, with all the mapping that's going on, with all the different kinds of ways we have of relating in early, very babyhood, toddlerhood, and childhood, I'm talking about incarnation. This is how we get into our flesh. All of these ways that I've shown you. How we get into our flesh. We don't always appreciate the amount of work that happens unconsciously in our embodiment. And if we don't get embodied in a very almost concrete way, if we don't feel that meanness, we don't have a very firm foundation for the rest of our lives. I will explain that more and later. Let me show you some other systems at work. If I'm overwhelming you, that's good. This is called the second brain. But I call it the first brain because it's online in the womb and when we're born. Did you know that there were 100 million neurons in the gastrointestinal system? Talk about neurons that are available to us as kids.
1 million.
Is that 1 million? I guess I don't know how to write 100 million. 100 million neurons reside in the lining of the gastrointestinal system. And they arise from the same group of cells as the head brain. And they operate just as the head brain does. They're alive in the womb at birth, sending and receiving messages, learning from the past, very connected with the head brain, but can work on its own. And it remembers. It gets conditioned very early on. It's fully alive in us. All 30 classes of neurotransmitters, 80% of the body's immune cells, are in constant communication with the rest of the body and the head brain. We can, for example, choke with emotion from the neurons in our throat. No wonder we have things like irritable bowel syndrome, for example, because we often get conditioned in some very traumatic ways. I probably have said this before. When Einstein was asked if he only had one question to answer, what would it be that needed to be answered? And he said, is the universe friendly or unfriendly? And this is where we find out when we're...
People didn't hear the question.
Oh, the question... if there was only one question, Einstein was asked, what would it be that you need to answer? And Einstein said, is the universe friendly or unfriendly? Did you hear that okay? Okay. And this is when we find out with all of these systems that are working within us. I didn't even go on with the heart, but it's, you know, it's 70% neurons. Babies' and toddlers' hearts are very open. And they start beating in the womb, obviously, and they beat continually. I mean, that's quite a muscle that beats all that many times until we die and it stops. I could say a lot about the heart, but that would take a whole lecture in itself. That would. Anyway, let me go on. One thing that doesn't happen in the first couple of years is explicit memory. I have that first. It doesn't happen in the hippocampus, which is part of the limbic system. And I'm not even saying anything about the limbic system, which is on full line at our birth. And that is called the emotional brain, especially the amygdala and the... Let's see. Well, I won't get into that. The hippocampus is part of the limbic system, but it comes online around 2 years old and later, when the child begins to be aware of time sequence, past, present, and future. And the child can use I in reference to herself. Like, I got up this morning, went to preschool on the bus, my mother picked me up, I had a peanut butter and jam sandwich for lunch, and went to play with a friend. I had fun. That is when the hippocampus kicks in and autobiographical memory starts. The developmental phases of the second year suggest that a child is developing a sense of the physical world and moves into more sequential and more consciously accessible forms of memory that can be retrieved in adult memory. Now, very few people can really remember back to 3 and 4 and 5, but some can. I can, for example. Or else I've had help in dreams. So, the thing that is very important is this. Implicit memory. That's how we learn. In the womb, at birth, and until 2, 2.5. And it relies on brain structures that are completely online at birth, especially the limbic regions of the brain. Implicit memory, and this is the important sentence, does not require conscious processing during encoding or retrieval. This is the earliest form of learning, completely nonverbal, and what we learn are mostly embodied emotional reactions to mother, father, family, and the atmosphere of the home. Nascent consciousness, according to Antonio Damasio, begins as embodied reactions to emotional events. It's emotion, not cognitive. Not yet, not for a while. And these are precursors to Jung's understanding of the complex. We have no objective memory of these early emotional experiences, nor what effect they may have on our later relationships. When someone comes to me and says, you know, I don't know why I don't like that kind of woman. She seems nice at first, and then she turns out to be bossy, but I think that's just who I am. This person has no idea how much conditioning has been laid down in the first 2, 2.5 years of life. That's in implicit memory. And these things can come up unexpectedly in someone later on. And they affect our way of relating, because they're the first things we learn in babyhood and childhood. Okay. So I just wanted you to be aware that our first learning doesn't take consciousness at all. It just comes in. And is remembered somewhere in the body. I think that's why I do body work. I'm an odd Jungian. You know, I don't send people to someone else. I have a massage table. I used to get down on the floor when I was younger and work on a mat. Because so much of that implicit memory is caught in the muscles and in the body. And it doesn't come out in just ordinary talk therapy very often. It can sometimes, but not very often. And until we can learn somehow to use perhaps our right brain more than our left, I don't think we're going to get to some of these things very easily. Okay. I'm just going to... go ahead.
So thinking about the body work and in association with Jungian analysis, when you're doing body work, is there a sense that these memories are contained in the body and that through the work there's some opening or release or even like a dam bursting open? Is that your experience of the work?
You know, sometimes, let me give you an example. I was working with a woman on the table. I was working with her feet. And all of a sudden she said, "I don't know how you can do that. Don't my feet smell?" And smell, the very primal of some of the senses, can take us right back into some of those very early places. This was partly a conscious memory, but part she didn't know when it had started. And she remembered that as a child, she used to try to tiptoe down the stairs in order to get out the door and into seeing a friend or something without the father catching her, because usually he was sitting in his chair with his legs up and he asked her to massage his feet. I mean, there were all sorts of incestuous undertones and overtones in this, obviously. And she remembered his feet smelled. And this father had slept with his mother until he was adolescent. I don't know why or what. But he obviously needed something from that daughter that felt illicit somehow. And she had hidden that for years, but it came up when I was working on her feet. Now, you don't do that in ordinary talk therapy, probably. Anyway, that would be an example of how explicit memories sometimes have whiffs of the implicit in them. So, I don't know if that answers your question or not. Yeah. It happened to be located in the feet. Or the memory came up when I was working with her feet.
Well, I do have a follow-up. I have the idea that traumatic experiences are knotted into the, like, the muscle fiber of the body and can be released. And I'm wondering if that's...
That happens sometimes, too. When I was working on a woman's shoulders, for example, I released them, and she said, "Oh, that feels good." But then they went right back the way they were before. You know, we have a body structure that we put together as children, usually. She was an Amazonian type woman. You know, she had a career. She was not married. She did everything by herself. And there was no way that she was going to let go of her shoulders, obviously. So something was caught there. There's another woman that I work with that that's the only place she could pull herself together. So you see a very tight under the back of the neck, right in the middle of the upper back, something that is very tight. And that's where she pulled herself together. So, yeah, you can release it. I remember using my hands and following where they wanted to go on the person. And I remember a woman came to me and wanted to do body work. They often know that I do that. And I waited, and finally, one hand went on her forehead and one on her belly. I don't know why. And she relaxed a bit under my hand. And then she remembered that her mother, she doesn't remember her mother really touching her very much or ever touching her. She had a hard time to find a memory. And that activated that. And then I moved my hands down to her belly and she said, oh, there's a swamp in there. And she had put, she had literally put everything that shamed her in that place. And when I would release a hip or something, or just put my hands there, that would come. I've had some very strange experiences. I worked with a man who was an entrepreneur. He was, oh, just a wonderful guy. And when I worked with him on the table, when I released his right arm, it was a normal right arm. I mean, very, very well connected to the shoulder and released. And then I did the left arm. Even though it looked the same size, my hands were telling me it was a child's arm. I mean, strange things like that will happen to me. And I will know that there's another side of himself that is very young. So I don't know if that answers the question or not. Okay. Anyone else? Yeah.
Yes. You had mentioned that you had some trouble sometimes recalling when you were 2 or 3, but you had help from your dream.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can you be more specific for that?
Okay. Peter just asked me, I didn't always remember what happened at 2 or 3 or 4, but I had some help from dreams. And I'll give you an example of that. I had a dream where I was in a running board car, you know, that's the kind of cars they used to have. And I was sitting in the back seat with my maternal grandmother. And we were going to the hospital because she had a terrible pain in her belly. And they, obviously, it was in the night and they had to take me too. So I was sitting in the back seat in the dream with her. And that actually did happen to me. And it brought back memories at about 13 months of going to the hospital, having her, you know, take my hand and go in with her little suitcase. And that was the last time I saw her. She died on the operating table of metastasized cancer. I don't know how she survived that long. And I remember coming, that was the dream. I was in the back seat with my grandmother. And then I remembered that. And I was only 13 or 14 months old. I mean, I knew that happened, but I sort of remembered being there in it, you know. And that's the kind of help I've had from dreams, yeah. Or once I had a dream of a baby girl being pressed down in the crib, being pressed down like that. And that brought back a memory of my father doing that to me, to make me go to sleep. Well, I just wanted to play, and I popped up all the time. And he finally just held me so tightly that I began to be really scared. But I had that dream of someone pressing on me in a crib. So dreams can do that, yeah. Anyone else? I know I've said a lot so far.
Have you heard of anyone having memory back to the womb?
Well, I'll have to confess, I did, but it was on an LSD trip. I dreamt that I was being pulled out by forceps from the womb. And I could get... and then I looked into the record at the hospital and they said that actually happened.
Well, I've had experience of when I was a young boy having... during fevers, I would have an experience that later I came to understand must have been a womb experience. I'll tell you about it sometime.
Okay,
but,
wonderful.
But I've heard of other people having such experiences, which is why I wanted to ask.
Yes, yeah. As I say, I had that. Yeah, go ahead.
It's hard to explain.
Oh, I know. I know. Yeah, yeah. Memories will come. Wait a minute. But if you want to go there, oh, I didn't bring it. Oh, yeah, I did. Let me tell you about a woman that I've been working with for quite a long time. A middle-aged woman, a therapist herself, brought in a dream about her personal mother in which she could do nothing right in the dream. You know, you will have that kind of dream. She spoke of the subtle ways in which her mother shamed her around her size and her large extroverted energy. And so she grew up with a sense of too muchness, you know. She was too big. She was too much. She was too extroverted. With her extroversion, I mean, there's a wonderful image of her that she told me about going to a white picket fence outside her house, and a little girl was going by. She went over and says, "Will you come in and play with me?" A terrible loneliness, but an extroverted energy that went out and got what she wanted. So we worked on the table that same day. I suggested that my patient lay on her back and focus her breathing and attending to what parts of her body responded to her mother. And as I reached under her shoulders, she remarked how they seemed to tighten up every time she mentioned mother. I confirmed that was happening as we continued talking about that dream. I suggested she take a moment to focus on her shoulders. Then she said, "I think there is an anger there, the deflating energy of my mother's need for control. I'm angry. But I suspect also this is the tightness of my own controlling energy." You know, she was a therapist. She went right to where it was, right where her psyche was. So we had moved from the external mother to the denigrating aspects of her internalized mother complex. So I noticed that her breathing was becoming constricted, and I sensed that my hands wanted to move toward her pelvic area. I placed them gently over her belly and suggested she send the breath in under my hands. "Oh, I can't," she replied. "It's solid concrete." Putting my hands alternately under her right and left sides, I waited until I could feel her body allow me to release her hip joints. And then she said, "Oh, the cement's cracking. I see a young girl's hand reaching up, and the rest of her is struggling to get free. But the harder I try, the more stuck she becomes." As my analysand surrendered into her breathing and stopped trying, the cement became softer, and a prepubescent girl sprang out wearing a red dress. "Oh," she declared, "she's a dancer." "No, she's an ice skater." "Oh," she declared, "I felt so klutzy then and ashamed of having to wear chubby-sized clothes. How can I let that ugly, unwieldy body take center stage, which she clearly wants to do?" So we had found that little child, that overweight, chubby child, which was the source of all her too-muchness feeling, that she was too much for most people. Usually I sit down after that and make sure the person comes back to the present moment. But we worked for the next few sessions on that little girl who had been released. Yeah?
What do you mean by releasing joints?
Well, I have to show you, I guess. I work on a table, I just let my hands be under the hips of someone, for example, till I feel that they're ready to release, and then just pull them out, and usually I go down the whole leg and let the energy out the foot. Something like, if that answers it. I put my hands under the shoulders or one on top, and each time I ask the person to go there to see if there's anything there that they need to work with. So it's hard to put it in words sometimes. Okay. Let me... what I want to do is show you, since we're Jungians, for heaven's sakes, how Jung discovered that body and psyche are one. And this was way back in the early 1900s, when he was one of the psychiatrists at the Bergolzi Clinic in Zurich. And he had been given a test called the Word Association Test. How many of you know what that is? Okay, good number. Originally, it was designed to try to understand the difference of mentation between psychotics and normals. But what he discovered was something very important. He discovered that there's something that works in the unconscious and can come up at any moment when it's activated. Now, the word association test is 100 words of just ordinary, everyday things, like table, chair, knife, fork, and others. Of course, he did it in German. I do it in English. But, for example, and the directions are you come up with a single word immediately or as soon as you can. For example, if someone said table to me, I might immediately say chair. So what you have here, let's see where I have that now. Whoops, I don't need that. Can I? Thank you. As I say, I'm trying to put this together. Huh. Anyway, this is a man about 35, one of his normals, one of Jung's normals. And what he discovered over and over again was simple words. And he learned to do bar graph. This dotted line is the average reaction time. And so you can see there were certain words, like seven, knife, where the bar went way up high. And it took this man a long time even to come up with anything when knife was... And Jung said, where do I have that? When he was giving the Tavistock lectures, I had a direct quote, but I can't find it right now. Okay, well, he said something like, you can say a simple word that any child could come up with an answer to, and it takes someone a long time, and also there are bodily changes, like mumbling or stammering or movements or feeling very embarrassed. It's the body and the emotion takes over, and it lowers consciousness. And you can see the perseverating effect. The 8, 9, 10 are probably words that he would do fine with. But the emotional kinds of affects and intensity that came up when knife kept him from answering anything for the next 3 times. So he began to see how the emotions have an embodied sense, and they act one with the other. As I said, we first tremble, and then we feel fear. But he saw how intimately related body and psyche were. Let me see, maybe I have that quote here. This is when he was working more on the infrared end of the body-mind continuum, which is more sensate in this word test at the Bergolti Clinic. And this is where the essential basis of our personality is affectivity. Thought and action, as it were, only symptoms of affectivity. Now, the next sentence is the one I want. I regard affect, on the one hand, as a psychic feeling state, and on the other hand, as a physiological innervation state, each of which has a cumulative effect on the other. So we can't have an emotion without some bodily innervation. And that always happens. And sometimes it comes out of the blue, as it does here. Yeah. Okay. Hold on a minute. Any child could answer that, and all of a sudden he's mumbling or his body is twitching and completely unconscious of all of this. And body and emotion act on each other, and it lowers consciousness so much that he can't come up with just the answers to ordinary words in 7, 8, 9, in 8, 9, 10. Then he hits another spike, lance or spear. It doesn't have much of a perseverating effect. But then you go to 16 to beat, and then 18 is it even higher, and body. And Jung looked at that, and he said, I know I have it here. Here it is. I didn't know, he said to this man, that you had such a disagreeable experience. And the man said, I don't know what you're talking about. And Jung said, you know, you were drunk, had a disagreeable affair with sticking your knife into somebody. He got that. Jung was incredibly intuitive. You know, from the word association tests, and later they used machines, you know, to check skin conductivity and heartbeat and everything and pulse and all of that. He was one of the ones who was called to the Zurich police station when they had a difficult case, because he really started the first lie detector test that ever was. So here he saw how body and psyche were so, at one point he says they are one. And with all of these words, he got what this man long ago had happened to him, that he kept secret from everybody. No one knew, because he knew that to tell people, and he'd been in prison for a year for that, would destroy his respectable stature. So he never told anyone, so he was keeping it repressed. And he did this, yeah. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
He can't hear you.
Oh, okay. He diagnosed people from this word association test, just as I said here. And that was where he really came to believe that body and psyche were one. As I do. Only I have to talk dualistically, because we don't have a language yet that doesn't. Anyway. Yeah.
In my training, part of which was at the Institute in Zurich, Switzerland, they required that you gave the word association test to a fellow analyst in training, and then they gave it to you. And the reason for that, basically, is that, you know, we presume we are conscious people and highly functional, and you take the word association test, and my normal reaction time was 5 seconds. And with several words, my reaction time was 25 seconds. Now that is very disturbing when you realize that something unconscious mm-hmm. has been activated
yep.
and you think you're a very conscious person. So it was convincing empirically of the nature of the complex. Mm-hmm. It's part of Jung's theory of the complex.
Yes. He discovered the complex from these tests. And this is how he did it. That something very dark can happen, which lowers ego consciousness and involves the innervation of the body also, each one affecting the other. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Yeah. I didn't quite hear all of that.
So this is with words.
Yes.
This kind of whatever.
Words would activate something. Yeah.
Activate something. But what about all the other associations that might be placed in the body and the mind in a traumatic situation, such as it was really hot. There was a woman in a green dress. I mean, all those pieces that aren't words.
Don't they have to be expressed in words in order to be worked with?
I don't know. It's interesting. It's almost as if someone's telling
I will stay with something. I think if one is going to work in this area with right brain stuff, you have to be very comfortable around not knowing anything. You really have to be very comfortable with that, because a lot of the time you can sense something or feel something is because the other person is not aware of what's going on. There's something called induced countertransference, which I'm very aware of, because the other person is not feeling the feeling that they should be or should be feeling with the grief they're talking about, for example. And my eyelids will go down, my whole energy will go down, and I'll be feeling it for them. Is that the kind of thing you might be?
Yeah,
yeah. Once they start, well, this was, maybe I've used this illustration before, but I remember a young man coming to me, and he sat, and I just felt like crying. And I knew that something was bothering him. It was very nonverbal. And I said, you know, I can't hear much of what you're saying right now because I'm feeling so sad, like I want to cry. And then it turned out that it was a year since his grandfather died, and he had gone and to the funeral and buried the grandfather. And because he was so close to the grandfather and loved him, and his father was kind of jealous of the relationship, he had to hold all that in at the gravesite because his father was there. And he didn't somehow want to disturb his father or hurt his father, but he really loved his grandfather, who was the father figure for him, not his own father. And so once he said that and could feel the tears and could cry, I didn't feel it anymore. Yeah. So, and then we could work on that. And I could listen to his dream, which was all about loss. I can't remember what the dream was, but... Yeah. Yeah.
It sounds almost as if in the listing that we covered earlier, but the part that goes out to the empathic part, that your that empathic part in you was triggered and was uncomfortable at the with the distance with the disconnection between that there was something in you that there was something going on between you where it goes both ways that you yearn to be understood through understanding him than you're then understood, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Whatever gets triggered, that something was triggered in you that needed completion as well.
Well, maybe so. I often find that if I'm feeling a sadness of somebody who's not feeling it, it connects with some deep sadness in me, too. But I think that's why I go through... I think that's... we are connected in that way, yes. I'm not sure I'm completely understanding what you're asking.
That it's a shared space.
Yes. Yes. I'm very aware of that, the atmosphere of that shared space. Yes. And I can pick up... I'm pretty good at shame because I've been a shame-based person all my life. You know, I will flush and sort of get red, and I don't think it shows, but I'll get red in the face, and I'll know that some shameful thing is going on that they're talking about, but they're not into the affect. It's shared. I mean, maybe because I'm a shame-based person, I can pick it up more easily than maybe others can. But that's shared, in a sense.
But I wonder if part of the therapeutic process is when you feel that resolution of something
okay.
that is kind of goes back and
okay.
forth.
Let me, whatever I'm working on, I'm sure to get patients that are working on that very thing. I've never seen it fail. I don't know who else are therapists here. But when you're working on something, you're likely to get several patients who are working on the same thing. And if my consciousness doesn't change, if I don't change, then I don't feel the therapy is really working. No, there's a connection there. Very much so.
Yes. And I wonder if it's actually on that biological level that you were talking about early on in you know, your talk.
It feels that way because, you know, I work that way. I'm not an intuitive. I'm an introverted sensei. So I work with that, with the sense. I call it my somatic radar. But there's a connection there, obviously, when someone comes in with some problem that you're working on too. And it's very important to try to differentiate what's yours and what's the other person's also.
And what happens when that person picks up on
you? Oh! I had someone come to me, and he was a therapist. And he came in, he was very open and very empathic, and he'd pick immediately if I was sad or irritated or something, and he'd say, I'm concerned about you, Anita. And then I realized when he left, and I saw his back was completely closed and tight and tense, and I knew somewhere that something was not as open as he wanted to be. But I have had that experience where someone has been so tuned into me that they can tell immediately whether I'm feeling good or bad or what. That has happened, yes. Anyway, yeah, go ahead.
I'm just wondering if body and psyche are the same. Can you imagine or with your mirror neurons, see touch happen and then be touched? Like, can that be the same thing as being touched? Watching touch?
I'm not sure I heard everything right. Sarah, did you? Okay. Can you speak a little louder?
Okay. if body and psyche are the same, can your psyche go somewhere and give it to your body? In the sense of, can you imagine being touched? Is that, and that at some point you're the same as being touched? And is that something different than maybe a baby doesn't do that, but maybe we can now?
Is imagining being touched the same as being touched?
Yes.
I don't think so, really. Huh? Because what I'm talking about is incarnation and presence means honoring the flesh.
So what's, how is power of body and psyche? What does that mean when you say that?
How do I?
Is imagination part of your psyche?
Oh, yeah. But as Jung says, I don't believe that unless you have some kind of embodied experience, that you really have it inside. I remember in my training, for example, I was with several very intuitive colleagues going through the training with me. And they would have said it all before my more slower gathering process would come up with something, and they'd already said it. The one thing I discovered was that an intuitive who gets it only for a moment and really doesn't get it as fully as if they let it go into some kind of embodied place inside of themselves. I mean, you can imagine that.
And then what if you imagine it and bring it into your body? Like you're just
it's not the same as being actually touched.
But
is it?
What if you imagine the experience, maybe you've experienced it fully, and then imagined it, then you have that same kind of...
Okay.
You need to touch.
What I was going to do, and I don't think I'm going to have time for now, is to take you all into something, see if you can get back into that sensory world by working with a dream or talking in a dialogue to a character in a dream. Yes, in that sense, you need to use your imagination to get back into it. And you can feel that you're there. And that makes a big difference. Yeah. For example, when I did active imagination, I didn't know any other way of doing it other than being in it in a way I could feel myself walking towards something, or I could feel myself exploring something actually with my hands. In that sense, yes. Yeah.
Yes. I had a question. You mentioned Winnicott. He wrote a book called The Good Enough Mother, and the work he did with infants and play therapy. And my question is, what they say here also, what is your definition of a good parent? The reason I ask, the picture with your grandchild, my stepdaughter has two boys and she's pregnant again, and when I hold the grandkids, the feeling I had when I held my own kids was, I wish I could have been with my own kids emotionally, kind of like a grandfather attitude toward, you know what I'm trying to say? There's a detachment there where, that I was just curious, what's your definition of a good parent?
Well, it seems that I've learned a lot as a grandparent that I wasn't able to learn as a parent because I was too busy, and I had three different schedules, three under four, for example, for a while, all on different schedules. And I think I was too frazzled to be that kind of a mother, and I would have liked to have been. That sort of thing, I would do a lot of things differently, but I was in my 20s, for heaven's sakes. At least I had the energy then, which I wouldn't now. But that kind of presence is very important to any child. And I would say part of a good parent is being present in a way that the child can feel it, physically, embodiedly present. I know my grandson, I mean, I have two titanium hips and two titanium knees, thank God, because I can move around. But my grandson wants to play on the floor. He says, Grandma, get on the floor. You can do it. Just do it. So I get on the floor. But it's not so easy for me. But that kind of play, or that kind of being, I wish I had been more with my three daughters than I was, if that's any help. Yeah. But anytime you can be there fully, sometimes I will, at nighttime, when I was singing them a prayer song or reading a story, that was the one time I felt I was a parent that was there for them. And that was important. I don't know if that's helpful or not. But yeah, there?
We have on our refrigerator a little statement. Grandchildren, love them, spoil them, and send them home. That's the difference. 24 hours, staying up half the night, three kids under four, and being young and relatively unconscious, and still living out the inadequate, often, experience we had as children with inadequate parents, we're not going to be often great parents. I mean, one of the things that Anita was so delighted with when she started having grandchildren is she said, I get a second chance to do it better.
Yeah. I just wanted to show you this because Jung did families, and he showed in these curves that he discovered how to do, how a father, daughter one, and daughter two had similar kinds of reactions to the word. And here a husband and wife, and here an unmarried sister and a married sister, a little different. Now, Thayer and I have been together, well, over 65 years, but we will celebrate our 65th marriage soon. Whatever.
Wedding!
Yeah, anyway.
Anniversary.
Our anniversary. But, you know, our maps often are together, but they often diverge because we've been able to give each other a great deal of autonomy in our long time together. So, but here, maybe at least the wife in that kind of patriarchal marriage that Jung was familiar with probably gave in to the husband quite a bit. But sometimes one comes in analysis to try to create one's own lines here. There's one more. Let me see. Alan Shore, you know, is a wonderful researcher, and I did some things from him, which shows how prescient Jung was in his understanding of body and psyche, and the incredibly interrelationship of that. I wish I were 30 years younger, because all of the neuroscience and all the research with infants is proving what I've always known and done, you know? Hooray! The last one. When a child is held and hugged, brain networks are activated and strengthened, and firing spreads to associated networks. I think I would, even though I hugged my kids a lot over there, but I think I would have hugged them more as a good parent. Yeah.
I think it was the Wilkinson quote at the beginning, no mother, no baby.
Winnicott said that.
Winnicott. Mm-hmm. Is that gendered? Is it no mothering, no baby? The baby
needs... It's structured so that it needs other embodied neural networks, in other words, other people, in order to become fully separate and fully themselves.
Does it require the mother?
Well, the mother is usually the primary caretaker. I think so, yeah. Whoever's the primary caretaker. Or it can be aunts and uncles and things. You know, it takes a community. It takes a village sometimes. Yeah.
I'm thinking about your story about the young man whose grandfather had died and how you were feeling his feelings empathically when he wasn't able to. Mm-hmm. And for people who are naturally empathic and embodying the unconscious of someone else, and would prefer not to, at least in a given moment, or when you realize that that's happening, is there... Do you have any recommendations or tips on techniques for how to get out of that?
Well, before I did body work, I would go through a day of working and end up with a headache, and I wouldn't know where it had come from. And after I had gone through body work training, I was able to know immediately when that was happening and move it out of my system, you know.
And how do you move it out?
Well, sometimes if it's a particularly toxic situation, I sit with my elbows like this, feel it coming in through my arms and out my elbows. I will turn over and let my hair fall in a circle and let it ground. Or I will ritually wash my hands, or I will use sage, which I think is particularly good to correct that toxic feeling. There are ways I used to run, and I would be like Ichabod Crane, you know. And people used to think I was crazy, but I was throwing this person off and that person off and just freeing myself. Yeah.
So actually you embody the release of that.
Yeah.
I used to know someone who talked about having this problem.
Yes.
A very sensitive young girl who felt that a lot of the surrounding energy fields of people were invading her.
Yeah.
And she was told by a shaman friend to wear a hat. And it worked very well for her for a while. She wore a hat whenever she was out in the world, and she felt that that could prevent the coming in of people's energy.
Well, somewhere I imagine I'm wearing a lovely gold kind of outfit, you know. It covers me and prevents things from getting into me. Yeah.
Those are good ways, I think.
You can use the imagination then, and it's very helpful. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm curious about this idea of empathy and embodiment. And I was thinking about that same experience, and so it resonates with me. About if we are embodied, if we walk in the world in an embodied consciousness, then we allow others to be when we meet them, to experience that and to maybe become more embodied in their own consciousness. And I was thinking of not a therapeutic experience, but kind of a midlife embarrassing job experience where I was waitressing on an island where I'd worked professionally and never waitressed in my life. And I was outside and I was crying at a table and I pulled myself together. I went in to take this order of this family's order. We're sitting there. And this 7-year-old boy was just sitting there covering and he looked up at me. I wasn't crying or anything, but he just looked up to me and made me burst into tears and he said, "I miss my dog." And the parents were kind of confused, and they said, "We don't have a dog, but we're heading back home, and he's connected to this dog at their relatives." And it was a moment that felt like it wasn't even empathy; it was what you were speaking of. It was this embodied consciousness where my body being with my grief,
exactly,
and his body,
yes,
and his grief,
yes,
and it was this moment of interesting embodiedness. It was like that synchronicity that you talked about.
Thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. I think we're coming toward the end. Yeah. One. Yeah.
Going back to synapses. I've heard that children who aren't read to, who don't have emotional stimulus, verbal and emotional stimulation that children can't learn because they don't have a foundation. It's like building a house with
yes.
a foundation. Can you address that?
You mean there are gaps by synapses
yes.
in what happens to a child?
Right.
Well, that,
right.
well, there certainly are.
The synapses
yes.
don't connect. They don't flow.
No.
Because there isn't enough. There isn't stimulation. Frozen.
Right. Right.
Is there a way to undo that?
Well, perhaps in a good therapy, yes. Where the analyst becomes that person, that different model of presence than they had before. And maybe that can help close the gap. I've seen that happen with myself in a good analysis. And I've witnessed that happening also in my patients. I don't know if that's an answer or not. It's so individual. I know.
And as a teacher, I work with a lot of
yeah,
children.
I bet you do. Yeah.
From inner city.
Yeah. Well, the most important thing for you is to be as fully present to them as you can. I don't think there's any other way. And certain mentors and certain teachers have been very important in my life. And they've made up for the lack in my family. I think it's getting time to close. Since I started with are we losing our senses? Are we in excarnation rather than incarnation? What I've been talking about is how we get incarnated into the flesh. Yeah.
Huh?
Oh, since I started with are we losing our senses? And also with the sense that excarnation might now be happening rather than... I just wanted to bring you into the way we all incarnate as babies, as toddlers. As a going into adulthood. And I want to end with something that Rainer Maria Rilke, who's one of my favorite persons, has said. And I think this has to be done in the flesh, you know? For one human being to love another, that is perhaps the most difficult for all our tasks. The ultimate, the last test and proof, the work for which all other work is but preparation. And I hope we're not losing that through all the virtual worlds that we get caught in. So, thank you very much.